Now the mystical dark forces are concentrated at the back. Who's here for the first time? We've been talking, for those of you, about, we've been studying the famous section in which the Rambam deals with the fundamentals of Jewish thinking, of spiritual thinking in general. He starts with the subject of how to revise the past. That if you've made mistakes in the past, correct them spiritually. That means how to account for the damage, personally, damage in relationships, cosmic structure in general, how to fix that up. And that leads him in, which I'm not going to go through now, the structure, into the subject, all the basics that the spiritual world rests on. Free choice, this world and the next, reward and punishment. That's what this section deals with, and that's why we've chosen it. Now, the immediate section that we've been looking at, the subsection, deals with those spiritual activities which are so bad that could deny a person his existence in the next world. It means they could be so negative that a person could have no content left. Now, there's some things you can do that are so bad or so all-encompassing, let's say, that a person's entire spiritual being could be lost. There are 13 categories. In another place, the Rambam lists them as the 13 articles of Jewish faith, correspond to each other. It's not that the articles of faith are any more important than anything else in Torah. The Rambam will say right here that if a person just ignores one letter, one word of Torah, it changes. He's knocked out the whole system. Right? Yeah, electrical circuit needs to be complete. If you take out 1 millimeter of wiring, electrical circuit, the thing doesn't operate. That's how Torah is also. But these 13, not that they're more important, but these 13 are direct access to one's spiritual existence. I once met a man who said a Jew wasn't observant. So he tried to explain to me why it didn't have to be observant. So he said, because he derives spiritual power and he grows spiritually from everything that he does. The way he eats dinner is as important as the way he does something else. It's not true. Try to explain to him, it's not true. Just like the body is structured in such a way that there are vital centers and then there are less vital centers, there are some that are so peripheral that if you harm them, it won't harm the body at all. You cut the soles of the feet, right? The skin there is so dead, although it's part of you, and it's nourished by the body, but that won't harm your health in general. Then there are parts that are so critical that the smallest injury there would cost a life. And then there are places in between. And that's how the spiritual world obviously set up, as we've discussed here many times before. Since the spiritual world is an exact reflection of the physical world, actually the other way around, so if the physical world is set up that way, that there are more critical areas and less critical areas, then the spiritual world must be the same. And since mitzvahs parallel the body exactly, again we've discussed many times together, so there are some mitzvahs that are critical and others that are less critical. It doesn't mean, if you're bleeding slowly from anywhere, bad enough, so then you'll bleed out. It doesn't matter whether it's the tip of your finger, huh, or the jugular vein. The blood will leak out eventually. But some are worse than others. Some are more direct, right, a more direct injury, and others are slower. These 13 mitzvahs, or these 13 elements that a Jew has to contain, or be, these 13 are the jugular, if you like. They cause spiritual death more quickly than anything else. Let's put very roughly. And we began to look through the list. Now what we saw in the last couple of weeks were the first of the 13 categories consists of 5 subsections. Okay? And these are 5 categories of people who are called minim. I'm not going to go through the derivation of the word again, but in English we loosely call this some kind of non-believers or atheists. I don't exactly know the English word. It's not an appropriate English word. But it means people who knowingly cut off their connection to the spiritual world. Not unknowingly. I've tried to explain it before, and it should be clearly understood that most people in this generation don't fit into this category. Okay? Even people who lead sects which are anti-Torah, right? Within Judaism especially, and even without Judaism, well, let's put it this way, those who call themselves Jewish, who lead sects, or whatever you call them, branches, I don't know what you want to call them, of so-called streams within Judaism. You know what? You with me? We won't reform the custom here of not referring to these things by name. These things are not Torah at all. the people who lead those things, even the knowledgeable people at the head of those things who lead those things, probably even they aren't guilty of this, probably. And I wouldn't, I'm not envious of any who are, I can assure you. But even those who most knowingly lead people astray probably are not guilty of this, because to be guilty of to be in this category, you really have to know. You have to know the spiritual world intensely. You have to be really educated in Torah. You have to spend years in a yeshiva and really understand it in your bones. You have to be a great man in Torah, a great woman, and then reject it knowingly. That's very, very hard to come by. We had examples like that in Talmud, times of the Talmud, at least one famous example, but it's probably very uncommon today. People we have today are simply uninformed. Even the leaders of groups or movements that are anti-Torah are simply probably uninformed. If they knew anything about Torah, the depth and power and beauty of it is such that there's very little way that they could give themselves to a spiritual thing other than what Torah is. That's a pathetic option, alternative, that the only explanation must be that they don't know any better. However, they are liable, just while we're mentioning the subject, they are liable for losing their share in the next world. The Rambam makes it quite clear, not because they are atheists, but because they lead people astray. And we'll get to that. Right? If you belong to a sect of Judaism that doesn't subscribe to the Orthodox, let's call it Orthodox, it's not Orthodox, just Torah, doesn't understand that Torah is central, so then if you're a member of such a thing, you probably don't lose your share in the world to come, you just don't know any better. Not to say you were educated that way or born that way. And certainly against the individual we would have no, there's no mitzvah to hate an individual no matter who he is. We would understand that he's just uninformed. The leaders of such groups have got a much more unenvious spiritual accounting because they're leading people astray, but not because they themselves are evil in this sense or because they necessarily know what they're doing. And unfortunately it doesn't exempt them from this punishment. We'll see it in more detail a bit later, and maybe we'll talk about those themes and elements within and without Judaism also sometime. This, by the way, applies in a much broader sphere as well. There are many people who don't know this, but many Jews today who do things that they shouldn't be doing are not in the classical category. The tragedies that happen now, like suicide, for example. But it says in the all Jewish sources that it says very powerful things about people who are in that category, who do such things. But again, before you judge anyone, or before you assume anything about the fate of a neshama, of a person who committed suicide, a Jew, and before you get upset if it's somebody who happened to be close to you, and before you, at least more upset than you have to, the person should know that the fate, the horrendous fate that's described for people who take life, whether it's their own or others, and in some way their own may be worse because you are more closer guardian of your own life than somebody else's in a way. Those things probably don't apply today. I mean, it's very bitter comfort, but that depth of tragedy, that depth of that awesome negativity that's described probably doesn't apply today for two reasons. One is that people are just generally uninformed, so they don't understand what it really means. And even more deeply than that, we are so deeply disturbed today. Anybody who does such a thing almost certainly wasn't of sound mind at the time that he did such a thing. Right? And that severely limits the responsibility. I'm not by any means saying it's a good thing or can be exonerated or that one should not disapprove. Of course not. But again, that's just one painful example of an area in which people just function out of not being informed. There's certain problems in marriage that occur also because people just don't know any better. And our generation is generally not considered to be powerful atheistic generation, but rather what's called amaratim. We just don't know any better. Right? Of course, you're responsible according to how much you know. Don't get carried away with this. According to how much you do understand, and even if you're just aware that there is something to be aware of, so then according to most authorities, you're liable already. Can't excuse yourself and say you didn't know. You might be able to say you didn't know the details, but you can't say you didn't know that there were details to be discovered. And that all goes in proportion, as we've discussed many times before. Now, with that brief introduction, we saw the following sub. By the way, for those of you, you're encouraged to ask questions on a Sunday night if I can answer them, and if they're on the subject. Done will rush. Yeah. That's a very, very good question. And I actually can answer that question, but it's not directly on the subject now. Do you mind if we leave it until we... The Rambam will get in a while, Lee Neder, especially if you remind me, is going to come in a short while to the oral tradition, the Torah as it's represented in the oral tradition, and he's going to explain that somebody who doesn't accept that also doesn't have a share in the world to come. Not only the written law, which is contained in what we call Chumash, or what they call the Bible. Under that heading, Lee Neder will try to discuss a little bit about what the oral tradition is, and the stature of those who carry it down to us. That will give you some idea of why the Rambam is called the Great Eagle. That's what he's called. In most of the printings of this book, you'll see in the beginning, it says, Sefer HaMitzvos, La Nesher HaGadol, Rabbeinu Moshe Bichon, the Great Eagle. To understand that, amazing thing. I haven't seen that anywhere else. Rabbeinu Moshe Bichon. So we'll try and understand that. For now, you can take his word. Okay, I assure you. There just isn't anybody else that compares. No one else put together a composition like this. Okay? That's the first element. The second element, just for now, to remember, is that this is not the Rambam's opinion. What's called the Noisei Kalim. Noisei Kalim means those who carry the weapons. Those who carry his weapons, the ones who printed around the page, like the armor bearers of a great soldier, they quote the references. They annotate the Rambam, referencing you to the sources. They're not the Rambam at all. They take you to the Gemaras, which actually say these things in just these words, almost always. And the Gemaras are traced back to sources in Chumash also. And that's traced back to Sinai. Okay? So this is, all the Rambam is doing is objectively, coolly, without any emotion, transmitting to you the Sinai tradition. We'll have to look at it in more detail. It's an excellent question. And we'll try and see any more. The question you should have asked is not how we can rely on the Rambam. Hear me, for sure you can rely. The question is how you can rely on me. Because I'm not just reading the Rambam to you, I'm telling you my own, not my own, but I'm bringing down to you what I've learned from great teachers. You. Don't ask. Okay, the truth is you can't rely on me. Okay. I do my best to give you the exact representation of the way I learned from my Rebbe and other great people whose credentials and whose greatness are not even in question, and if you would spend half an hour with any of them, you'd definitely understand that yourself. In fact, you should go and do that. But I do my best to give it over as objectively as possible. Okay, so the five subcategories of these types of people who are called atheists, with all that we've said in the background, are as follows. We're not going to explain them again, we're just going to read where we've reached up to now. The first is, Ha'emesha en sham eloika, somebody who says there is no transcendent being or power, Va'en lo elam manik, which means that the world has no leader or controlling or transcendent dimension at all. Okay? That's the person who looks at the world like a monkey. He thinks he's a gorilla and he thinks everybody else is, and the world generated itself and there's no meaning to anything, there's no higher values. Such a person, if he really understands what he's saying correctly, actually doesn't believe in anything at all. Doesn't believe in beauty or justice or truth or love or anything like that, because those are all abstracts which are a function of human understanding. So actually this person, which is what this Western scientific world is these days, now it is a system that believes exactly that. Intellectually, when you speak to them, they'll tell you exactly that. That's what we live in. That's the context in which we're placed right now. That the world actually just is a grouping of evolved gorillas. That's their understanding. Of course, as we pointed out many times before, they think that with their minds, but they don't understand that with their hearts. As we pointed out many times, they certainly don't live their lives that way. Right? Except for a few outstanding individuals who managed to develop this theme of wickedness to the point of its logical extension, like the great, so-called great existentialists who actually committed suicide or murder, right, because they came to an understanding that actually life is meaningless, and to prove it, actually gave themselves, you know, passively or actively to death, or wrote about it at least. Most of them never did it. They just toyed with the idea and wrote about it. Meantime, they had a very good time in life. If you study their lifestyles, you'll see. But that's the philosophy. Of course, if you look at their behavior, you'll see that almost always it doesn't reflect that. As we pointed out many times before, the biology professor at university who tells you that he's just a gorilla and that his wife's also just a gorilla, when she runs off with the professor of sociology, he doesn't just dismiss it as one more gorilla. He takes it much more seriously than that, because he actually has got a gnawing sensation somewhere inside that actually there's something meaningful about human relationships and so on, and that can be relied on, that feeling. Look, that has to be discussed in more detail. If you don't have that feeling, then you're right, you are a gorilla. Now, it all depends on that inner knowledge. That's the first category, okay? That's the big overall category. By the way, I just point out to you, we didn't point this out last time, this is the first generation in the history of the world that's had such a philosophy. I don't know if you're aware of that. Generally speaking, it's the first generation, the last 100, 150 years, the first generation in the history of the world that actually bases itself on complete atheism. It's a remarkable fact. All previous cultures and generations aspired to something higher, even if they cooked up their own version of it, like the Greeks, who made up a whole system of God figures. But all cultures, from what we call the most primitive to the most advanced, if you look into their sociology, you'll find that they bury their dead with artifacts to take into the next world. There are many, many elements of understanding that they have that there's a world after this. This is the first generation in the history of the world. It's remarkable because it's the lowest generation that actually intellectualizes at least about this being all there is and what meets the eye is all there is and nothing further than that. That's the first category. Secondly, however, she'yesh shamanik, there is, those who say that there is a transcendent being, aval hen shnayim o yoseh, but there are two or more. This is a person, the first one is someone who denies the existence of Hashem. The second is someone who denies the unity of Hashem. He claims that there is a transcendent infinite being, but just that he's got more than one root manifestation. We've discussed this before also. Thirdly, and this is what we saw last week, somebody who says that there is one master of the world, he does exist and he is one, aval bat shehu guf uval tmuna. He has some corporeal element. He has a body or some kind of image or form, right? Something tangible or even tangible in the abstract that is, even if it's a Kabbalistic diagram, but there is some sort of discernible type of a form, that is somebody who has no share in the world to come. Okay? Again, before we panic about these things, it means somebody who knows what he's talking about and he really means it and he lives that way, not just somebody who has a doubt. Everybody has doubts, and that's what doubts are for, to provide an ordeal. A person who has doubts or negative thoughts doesn't mean he loses his share in the world to come. That is what we discussed last week. Now, let's see what the next category is. And the Rambam says the following thing. Last week we dealt with the problem of how come the Torah talks about physical images. And if you weren't here, perhaps you can get the recording. That subject is very important. If we're not allowed to believe that Hashem has any physical image at all, so why do we talk about Hashem's hand and his eye and his foot and so forth, and the Torah speaks that way? It's a very challenging problem. We did our best last week to try and work it out. The next category is this. Somebody who says that Hashem is not alone, the first being and cause of everything. Tzur means actually sayar. It means the, in English they call it the prime cause or the first cause or the former of everything else that exists. So try to understand this. That means you can have a person who accepts that Hashem exists. He can accept that he's transcendent and infinite. He can accept even that he's one. That's not bad. But then he says, and he can even accept that he has no corporeal element. That means if you try to, there's no way you can conceive of Hashem in any physical form or image at all. Only this person says that Hashem wasn't first. That means, now, you have to be careful. Of course he can't mean that there's an infinite being that actually isn't infinite in time. He doesn't mean that. But he means that when Hashem came into being, if you could talk that way, he found raw material. I'll tell you how the Rabbit puts it. He says this. The Rabbit commenting on the Rambam says like this. And also someone who says that Hashem is not the first, Amar Avram, says the Rabbit, like that one who says, right, there were people who said this, and still do, Elokeichem, your God, speaking to the Jewish people, Tzayar Godol Hayo, is a great artist. He was a great artist. Elashem Matzaloi Samanim, but he found for himself raw materials. He's doing great raw materials. Toyu Vavoyu, which means the formless mass out of which the universe was shaped. Choshech, darkness, mayim, water, ruach, air, ubahem, asa, mashals, and with those he did what he did. In other words, this is the philosophy that Hashem came into being, or whatever you want, existed, but he existed together with raw material. Some kind of formative raw material, and what he did was he formed that raw material into, right? What this philosophy does not believe is what we call yesh me'ayin. Yesh me'ayin is the moment of something becoming, nothing becoming something. Okay? That's the crux and the core of Torah. That we believe that the world is formed out of nothingness. And that's a very difficult idea. But that's what we believe. Right? The person who doesn't believe that, and of course you can feel the problems with not believing that, because it means that Hashem is not absolute. It means that there's something besides Him, raw material. Yeah? He didn't create the raw material. The raw material exists in and of itself. How? They don't say. No one knows. Right? Doesn't bother them. But He worked with the raw material. The concept of Yesh Ma'ayin, meaning that the world came out of nothing, just needs years of explanation. But a few ideas that we need to keep in our minds are as follows. The important thing to remember about this whole discussion is that nothing in the world, we understand that nothing in the world is a real creation. Be very careful about this. We understand that everything in the world is just a revelation of something that wasn't visible before. Okay? In the mystical writings, they don't talk about things being created, they talk about things being revealed. The reason we speak that way is because Hashem's existence always is and was. So it can't be that something came into being. The only thing is, it was brought into what's called Gilui. Gilui means that you didn't see it before. It was revealed as this thing, right, at a certain point in time. I'm not sure that helps much, that idea, but that's the way to think about it. And therefore, we have many ideas that come out of this. One of them is the fact that Hashem doesn't create the core of energy or being. He just creates the filters that hide His existence enough so you can see what's left. That's a very important mystical idea. Okay? If you want a very crude image, it would be something like this. Again, images are always fraught with danger, but something like this. If you can picture white light, actually white light is made up of components. Right? Actually. Except there's no way you can see those components. White light has seven elements that make it up. Actually, it's an infinite spectrum of colors that make up the white light. But you can't perceive those colors in the white light. The only way you can break down the oneness of white is if you put colored filters in front of the light. What those filters do is they absorb all the other colors except theirs, and then that light shines through. Are you with me? So the only way you can perceive the components of unity is by putting a device in the way that actually limits the power. You follow me? By shining more lights on the scene, you won't see what white light is. You follow me? In fact, you'll blind yourself. The only way to see what's in it is to take filters that are correctly chosen, and the more filters you put, the more you'll be able to see the elements. Or you need a prism. Something that breaks up the unity in a certain way. These images are all in the world to teach us this thing. And therefore, the mystics say that what Hashem created was not a world of multiplicity. He just created the filters that hide His own being. And as the filters are more and more powerful, so you see more and more differentiation. You see more and more physical reality. Are you clear? I don't believe you. There's a contradiction in the whole thing that we can't understand. Yes, you're right. We can't understand how that could be either. But that's, for now, as far as we can go. We can go a lot further than this before we admit that we can't go further, right? Which we always have to do. But right now, we can say this much. Many wonderful ideas come out of this, and I'll share with you two of them. One is the fact that it says the following thing. We say it in the davening, and you'll see it in Pasuk. It says, Oisei Sholem Uvoi Rei Ra. Hashem creates, He makes peace, and He creates evil. Now, we have to have another discussion some other time about what evil means and how it comes into the world. That's the real problem. The world, if you think the world's a problem, how there can be a finite world in an infinite being, but how the world can have evil in it, out of a creator who's only goodness, well, that's a real problem. And that we discussed on a Monday night a few months ago. If you can't wait until we get to it again, you can look out the cassette on the source of evil. But the fact is that evil somehow does come down here. And the way we understand that is as follows. The verse says that Hashem makes good, or you say shalom, or He makes peace, and He creates evil. So at first glance, and you're going to see an amazing paradox here, it seems opposite of what it should be. Because the word to make is a much lower word in the mystical world. To say that He makes peace is a very low word. But boirei ra is the word of creation. That's a very powerful word. That word means He makes something out of nothing. So how do we understand that the verse says Hashem makes peace, which is a lot. Makes just means a manipulation. He just takes the pieces and puts them together. That's how He makes peace. Right? Shalom, which means shlemus, completion, perfection, the ultimate. But evil, it says, He actually creates out of nothing. A much more powerful spiritual word. It's a very big problem. The answer is obvious. There's many, many explanations. If you look in Tanakh, you'll see it in Yeshaya 45, I think. But The idea that we wish to extract for this evening is this. The reason that it says Oseh Shalom, that peace or perfection or unity he manipulates, is because it always was there. Actually, he doesn't create it out of nothing. Perfection and harmony and the oneness of his light, that always was there. Are you with me? So it would be completely false to say that he creates that out of nothing. All he does is he reveals it. He lets you see it. He manipulates the filters in such a way that you can see it. But evil is created something out of nothing. Evil comes into the world as something that really wasn't there before in the spiritual core. But when the filters start getting put in the way, one of the amazing effects of that is that evil results, even though you won't find it at the core. If you trace the source of evil high enough, you find that it traces itself to a source of goodness. But that goodness, are you with me? That goodness, not a single nod. You're going to fire me. The source of that evil actually is goodness. But when you put enough filters in front of it, it comes out evil. A very simple analogy, if you want, would be when a parent is punishing a child. So everybody on the outside would see only badness and pain and suffering, and the child certainly would perceive that. But if the child would understand what the process is that's going on, they'd understand a very deep manifestation of the parent's love. Very much deeper, in fact, than when the parent manifests kindness on the child, because it takes a lot more self-control and a lot more depth, and it causes a lot more pain to the parent to punish a child when a child should be punished than when a parent just showers love on the child. But of course you can't see that, and even if a child tries to tell himself that while the parent's smacking him, it's very hard to relate to it. And of course that's the situation that we're in the world. Everything bad that happens, we understand, has a source in goodness. In the mystical writings, they describe it as the neurological pathways. Do you know that in the human brain, the right side controls the left side of the body, and the left controls the right, and certain of the pathways cross and some don't? And if you read the mystical works that talk about these things, they are exactly like texts of neuroanatomy. Right? And what they mean is that what looks like left down here, which is called the evil side, actually when you trace it up, you find it's located on the right side. It's a remarkable thing. Actually, the higher you go, the more everything is located on the right. But tonight is not mystical night. But that is a brief. So that's one idea that comes out of this fact that Hashem puts the filters in the way. Okay? That it is something that's created. And another idea that you should remember is this. You should remember, Jews should always know, when we talk about something from nothing, the great Hasidic thinkers say that actually we mean nothing from something. You follow? When we say Hashem created something out of nothing, actually that's only the way we see it. We perceive that there was nothingness beforehand, and now the world is. So that's called something out of nothing. But actually, it's nothing out of something. What was there before was real. What was there before was a manifestation of Hashem's oneness. That was a powerful white light. Now what happens is he takes away the light. In other words, he's blocking out reality. That's why we see ourselves, we see a world, only because the filters have been placed in the way. So actually what he's doing is actually creating less than there was before. You follow me? But of course we always speak about the world the way it reveals itself to us. So we say he creates something out of nothing. Yesh me'ayim. Something from nothingness. Actually, if you break the word bereshis in the beginning, it spells barata yesh. You created yesness, or yeah, is existence. You created existence. That's what it says. Okay, that's the idea. That's the problem with this individual. He says that Hashem did not create the first. He wasn't first. See the next category. For those who knew, it isn't always this heavy. V'chein, ha'oved k'richa v'mazal. Similarly, next category. Somebody who worships means he connects himself to, as a source of power, a star or an astrological power or configuration, bezuloso, anything else like that. To be an intermediary between himself and the creator of the world, master of the world. Any of these five categories is a min. Let's just try and understand this last one. That's unfortunately a very common problem today, that people actually, this is one that we do in large scale transgress today. People who connect themselves to spiritualism, or astrologers, or fortune tellers, or palm readers, or teacup readers, or coffee grounds, speculators, or whatever these things are. There's a fortune of them in Israel, unfortunately, today. There are a lot of people who do this. There are charlatans who read your mezuzahs, or they'll read your tefillin, right? Definitely. And they'll see, because your tefillin are like this and like that, and this and that's going to happen. And very often people who are based on certain valid sources, okay? The sign of these people is, general sign is that if they take money from you, then it's invalid, okay? Torah teaching and Torah helping people is not Right? So Hillel writes clearly that anybody who goes around taking money for that kind of thing, first of all, the whole idea is usually very suspect. But certainly if they take money for these things, then you should not give credit to such an individual. Now, it may be more problematic if the money is being donated to yeshiva or something like that, but generally you should be very careful. The problem with astrology, we have touched on it briefly before, I'll just mention the salient elements right now, just because it's so common, and spiritualism also. The problem with it is that the whole essence of being Jewish is that we go to the source, we don't go to intermediaries. We once, a few weeks ago, discussed in detail that the idea of relating to an intermediary between the source and you, the problem with that is that if you do it, you correct, then that becomes the source. It's not fooling yourself. Okay, that's the problem with the system. It's not being, we tried to explain once before, that a Jew who worships what, let's call it idolatry, right? People who worship idols, they didn't worship carved shapes in wood. They worshipped or related to forces in nature. They may have represented them by certain images, but they related to forces in the world that are absolutely real and correct. And very often people with very deep perception about those forces, and some of the predictions that they perceived were actually correct and are correct. Still people who can do that today. Unfortunately, the problem is that those are the channels through which the energy flows. The energy definitely flows through those channels. And therefore, a person who connects himself up, the energy does flow down the way he perceives it. But the essence of being Jewish is that you go beyond the flow of energy through the channels, and you can challenge it. You know, you can bring out an energy that's completely beyond the channels. That means it doesn't flow in any defined pathway. Are you with me? And you can cause things to happen by your own stature as a Jew. It's a special gift that Jews have. Non-Jews don't have this. The non-Jewish world fits in with the flow of energy in a certain way that's also very beautiful for them, but has to be used correctly. I'm not going to go into that now. But the Jewish neshama is such that it transcends the source of the energy and causes the energy to flow down in an unusual pathway. You have to do it. It doesn't happen automatically. But the one way you block it from happening is if you accept the source. If you go to a fortune teller or an astrologer, I'm talking, of course, about somebody who's accredited. I'm not talking about somebody just a hoax, but somebody who knows how to read certain things. And even there's a detail, many, many details about it in the Gemara. People who know how to read these things in such a way that no one can be accurate. Only certain general things can be stated through these signs, but people who can do that can point out certain signs. If you accept it and lock into it, it becomes virtually inevitable. Okay, which is the greatest tragedy. That's why we avoid connecting with these energies. If you want to know the halacha is that if somebody tells you such a thing that you know is correct, you're someone who knows what they're talking about, tells you that this and this and this is going to happen to you, you are allowed to take cognizance of it. That you're not required to disbelieve it. You'd be a fool to disbelieve it. But you have to take steps then to try and avert whatever it was. But you may not inquire about that, because then you put yourself into the system. So what we have a mitzvah called Tamim Tiyeh. It means walk purely with Hashem without investigating these strange pathways. It's one of the reasons that people who investigate these things, one of the consequences is bizarre tragedy in the family. Bizarre forms of tragedy in the family, in families that are connected. Last year I was involved myself with four cases here of families that suffered the most, not just tragedies, but horrendous and bizarre things that happened. And it turned out, in all cases, there was a parent in the family who was involved in spiritualism. Okay, that is one of the consequences. Another area that one has to understand also is dreams. Okay? Now, dreams, the Gemara has got a whole chapter, a whole perek talks about dreams, and there are many things that are definitely recognized and valid. Okay? But again, you have to know what you're doing. And you're not allowed to be superstitious. If you have a certain dream, to be superstitious about it, and forbidden to be superstitious. But there are signs, dreams are very powerful, and they're the last bit of prophecy that's left on earth. Okay, the last message from another world, from the correct source, today is vested in dreams. Messages from a different dimension through the impure source is rife today. Okay, you don't need to be great for that. Unfortunately, to draw down energy from the pure sources, you have to be very great. To draw energy from the black side, you just need a certain talent at that. Right? Some people are gifted in that area, and that's all you need. That's a tragedy. That's why you'll find much more proofs of that than you'll find on the other side. Because for that, you don't need work on yourself. You just need a certain ability, a certain talent, and you can bring down energy. And that's one of the signs. If somebody who's not obviously a person of great self-control and self-development is able to do certain wonderful things, on the contrary, that makes them very suspect. Because to bring it down from the pure side takes tremendous, tremendous effort. And that's much more harder to access, much harder to access. So dreams is a long subject. If one is interested, you can look in the Perek and Brachos that talks about it, or get somebody who knows more about it to tell you. But there are many things that are important about dreams. And if you have a need or particular experience, you can ask somebody who is... The one thing you shouldn't do is find out what are the signs that are significant, because then for sure you'll dream about them. The Gemara says that Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananiah was a very wise man, and it so happened that the king of... I think at the time it was the Greeks, if I'm not mistaken. The Greek king called him in and he said, "I hear you're a very wise Jew. So if you're so wise, tell me what I'm going to dream tonight." It's quite a challenge, that. So he said, "Sure, no problem. Tonight you're going to have a dream that the Turks, or whoever it was that were the Syrians, whoever was the enemy of the Greeks at that time, they're going to capture you. They're going to bind you in gold chains, and they're going to torture you like this and like that." And that night he had exactly that dream. So he thought this show was fantastic. Actually, he was just using an old trick, and that is that if you have a certain tension during the day, then definitely you're going to dream about that, because it's an escape valve for that kind of thing. So he didn't actually predict his dream, he actually caused it. It just was suggestible, and he gave him a very potent and hefty dream to think about. And so, of course, that's exactly what happened to him. But that is one of the reasons why, if you have a dream that's connected to what you thought about before you went to sleep, it's almost always non-significant. Right? You can take that as a big sign of relief. If you thought about something before you went to sleep during the day, or something happened to you, and that night you dreamt about it, so then it's not regarded, generally speaking, as significant. Right? Also, it depends what time of the night it happens. Certain time of the night is more significant than other times. Whether the dream's repeated two or more times also. And then also, what actually transpires in the dream. Okay? Another important factor is if you were disturbed by the dream. Sometimes you may have a very, very negative dream, but it didn't bother you. Okay? Sometimes you have a dream that seems quite innocuous, it leaves you feeling very uneasy. So in the mystical writings it says that's the kind to worry about. If it leaves you uneasy, even if it wasn't objectively negative, then you should try and do something about it. And there's certain things we can do about dreams that are negative. I'll tell you something that happened to me. I'm not a very... not given to these things particularly. Pretty normal sort of ordinary individual. I don't function in the mystical world particularly. And one night in Israel, my wife and I had the same dream. Exactly the same dream. Nothing we'd spoken about, nothing we'd talked about, no connection to anything in reality. It was a dream that involved a sign that for sure, or definitely means, unfortunately, means death. I mean, we both knew that, although we hadn't discussed this or thought about this for a long time. And remarkably, both of us woke up the same time, early in the morning, with having had exactly the same dream and remembered it clearly. So we rushed off to do what one should do in such an event, but actually it was too late. One of our neighbors had a guest from France, and that person just didn't wake up that morning. Quite a young man. I know they came to call me as a doctor to see what could be done, and that's what happened. Now, so I'm certainly not going to tell you what the dream was, because then for sure that's all you're going to dream about for weeks. But some dreams, finally, I'll just say this, some dreams that seem terribly immoral or terribly negative, the Gemara says, are actually wonderful dreams. They are fantastic predictions, they mean very good things. And some things that seem beautiful and fine actually are very negative. So it takes an expert, and you have to know there aren't many around. There are some standard things that anybody can tell you, but the depth of it, there aren't many people. Just to make it a bit more complicated, I'll tell you this, that the Gemara says that every dream has some nonsense in it. Okay? Every dream has something that's wrong. Because a dream is always something from the unreal world. We discussed this, I think, a week ago. Greater depth in this idea, but a dream is always something that comes from the world of unreality, from the world of imagination, and therefore always there's something that's wrong. You don't always know. You never know exactly what the detail is that's wrong, or how much of it, but there's always that. Yes, I thought there might be questions. In a dream, it is possible. It is possible, and there are many recorded cases. Yeah, the ones that are recorded in Torah history are ones that were very significant. Of course, they were brought down because they were significant and useful, and a person was able to do something about it. Whether it's valid today, if one has such an experience, one has to be sensitive to know whether, you follow, whether that was something valid or whether it was your imagination. Sometimes it doesn't make any difference. Sometimes, whether it is actually a connection with that person, or whether it's just because of your deep connection with that individual and knowing them so well that in the clarity of a dream, right, where you don't Yes, so you might be able to get an intimation of what they would say about a certain thing, whichever it is, but it may be valid from both points of view. But it certainly can be valid. This is not just, we're not speaking about spiritualism now, okay? This is in a dream. If a person gets in touch with a neshama from the other world, that definitely can be done. That is the most horrendously negative thing to do. If anybody tries to talk you into such a thing and they say that they'll provide guidance for you or whatever else it is, it's a very serious Torah prohibition. It doesn't help you at all. In fact, it complicates matters greatly and it causes intense pain to the neshama that's contacted. Okay, so it definitely can be done, but definitely shouldn't be done. Yeah. Any other questions on the subject? Yes, please. Because they're universal symbols. They are universal symbols. There are a whole list of universal symbols that always mean certain things. If I were to tell you them, you'd see immediately how they connect, right? With a little explanation, they're pretty obvious. Well, I'm just not about to do that. But that's pretty obvious. Then there are personal issues also, and that takes a little bit of depth and insight for a person to work out. I'll just give you a hint of what I'm talking about. Joseph interpreted dreams, right? He was able to interpret dreams. Why is it another discussion what was unique about him that could do that? So just to understand, just a little bit, one of them, before she says the following thing. You remember the dreams that he had to interpret? It was a baker and a steward. Remember? They both had a dream. The wine steward dreamt that he would squeeze the grapes. Right? There would be grapes. Right? Involved in his dream. And Yosef predicted that it meant that in 3 days' time, Pharaoh, Paroi, would restore him to his position of being his major wine, whatever it was. The baker had a dream that he was walking with three loaves on his head or baskets of bread on his head, and the birds came and pecked the bread, right? Ate the bread from his head, and Yosef told him that in 3 days he'd be taken out and hanged. Okay? And that's exactly what happened. So before she would say, there's got to be a connection. You know, what you follow? There's got to be a connection somewhere. It's not just that he doesn't mean he had some mystical power. But he had that also. But there has to be always a connection with the sign. How did he know that a baker with three baskets on his head and some birds pecking at the crumbs or the bread? So the understanding is like a very fantastic commentary that goes into some of the mystical ideas, explains like this. Birds don't come close to a living human being. Birds won't come close to you if you're alive. They'll come close to somebody who's not alive. You follow? If you're walking around with some bread on your head or in your hand, birds won't come and peck at that bread. They're afraid of you. They can sense the power of a living human being. The Gemara says that rats and mice and animals, rodents, they don't come near a living human being even when he's sleeping. Very, very uncommon for that to happen. Because they can sense that there's a certain aura that glows around a person who's alive. But when that aura leaves the body, animals can sense it immediately. From the moment that the aura is gone, from the moment the neshama leaves, rodents and things, and that's why we have this custom, la'aleinu, of sitting with someone who's not alive anymore, right? One of the main reasons, apart from other mystical reasons, is to protect the person from rats and mice. Right? Because they can tell that the person is not alive anymore. So Yosef understood that his birds were coming very close to this man. His aura had left. The shine, the glow, had left. And in fact, in all the mystical works, it says that 30 days before a person leaves the world, that special glow that surrounds the person, the aura, which is this mystical light that surrounds a human being, that fades away a certain amount of time before a person leaves the world. So he was able to see that. Yeah.
About the aura, I mean, there are undoubtedly people who can see auras. Okay? But are you allowed to
the question was that there was this light that surrounds the body called an aura. The questioner here is trying to slip in a question that's got nothing to do with dreams. She thinks that by now, 10 to 9, I'm already. I don't notice those things. But briefly, it's like this. Are you allowed to listen to such a thing? If somebody can read auras, right, if they can. The answer would be this. If somebody really can read it, if you're dealing with somebody who really is accurate, then there would be no reason not to diagnose certain problems from that. We generally avoid that whole area because most people can't be trusted in this kind of area. Since it's not objectively, the credentials aren't objective, So it's very difficult to know who is and who isn't, you know, operating honestly and who isn't. But if somebody generally would be able to know, I think there are sources in the mystical writings that say that on Rosh Hashanah they used to go into a dark house and look at each other's auras, to look in their reflection. There were things like that, and it probably could be done. But it's very much a lost skill today.
Yeah.
The question is, where are you when you're dreaming? And our understanding is like this. It's a very difficult question to answer, but the basic answer is like this. The concept that the mystics write about is that when you sleep, not dream, when you sleep in general, certain elements of the neshama leave the body. Okay? Certain elements stay within the body, the lower elements. The elements of the neshama that connect the neshama to the body, that means the life energy, the energy that a plant has, an animal has, that force remains in the body. If that didn't stay in the body, you wouldn't wake up. So last time that we did meet before Shavuos, for a week or so, and I thought it would be a good idea would be to pick up some loose ends of a subject that we've begun before. That's one of the most misunderstood things. It's not so clear. I don't know any sources that talk about it openly. We know that certain of the higher elements go to a world where a judgment actually takes place. Okay? A person is judged. The whole day, the day's activities, what a person did, are actually judged at that time when you're sleeping. Judgment, again, doesn't mean that, you know, there's a courtroom, and that means that there is a totality of consolidation of what you did that day that then comes down and becomes you. So the next day you go ahead with the extra spiritual power, with the energy that you generated from yesterday. That's if you used yesterday correctly. If you wasted yesterday, then what comes down is a source of sourness, right, of damage, and then you go ahead tomorrow more tired, less able to concentrate, less spiritually inspired about the world, and you basically just degenerate that way. You follow? So it has a definite consequence and an effect on you. So a person wants to send up his neshama in a very pure way, right? So therefore a person should go to sleep in the correct way. And that's why a Jew should go to sleep by Tumei. There are some differences which I'm not prepared to go into now, because it depends on many other factors, but generally, a person should say Shema before he goes to sleep, definitely, especially if people haven't said it in the evening. If you don't say Shema at night, in general, if you don't go to shul, you don't have a mirror, then you must definitely say it before you go to sleep. Definitely, must definitely have to say it. But even if you say Shema at night, you should say at least the first paragraph before you go to sleep. If you don't know it in Hebrew, or you can't read Hebrew, you should do your absolute best to struggle through it and break your teeth, get someone to write it out for you phonetically so that you can say the words, whatever it takes. Say the first paragraph, at least the first line, but you should learn the first paragraph in Hebrew, and you say that. And right after that, there are certain verses of protection that a person can say that provide protection against certain negative things that can happen in the night, various kinds. And then you should make a bracha, a mapil, which is a blessing, which requests certain protection and staves off certain problematic dreams and various other things. A person should do that, and after that you're not allowed to talk. Okay? Generally speaking, one's not allowed to talk after that bracha. Many sidurim, by the way, have it printed in the wrong order. I don't know about this sidur, but most of them have it printed. They first have the bracha, and after that, all the verses and Shema. And most customs hold. I'm not saying it's the end of the world, but most, probably what people should do is say the verses first and Shema, and end off with the bracha, because after that you shouldn't speak. If it's too lengthy for you to say all four or five pages, for most people it is, many people it is, then just say the first paragraph of Shema, one or two or three of those verses of protection, each one to be said three times, then a person should say a mapul and immediately should go to sleep. If you doubt that you'll fall asleep, if you're a doctor on call, or somebody who's likely to be woken in the next half hour, then you shouldn't make the bracha. Not only if you feel you'll sleep for at least half an hour. If you do sleep for half an hour or more, then when you wake up, you must take very great care to wash your hands correctly. Okay? When the neshama leaves the body, it leaves through the fingertips. What all this means, we can't go into now. But just, unless you can rely on me, okay? Take it from me for now. When you wake up after half an hour's sleep, especially before you touch anything, you must wash your hands very carefully from a kli, from a vessel with a perfectly round edge, okay, that holds at least a reverse of water, which is at least teacup full would be the minimum, would be certainly cover the minimum. You must wash three times alternatively, starting with the right hand. And you must wash the hands from the knuckles down at least, okay? Thoroughly, three times alternatively at least. Go on, holds four times, but three times is enough. Before you touch anything, all the sources say that if you don't do that, then certain things that you touch can be very seriously damaged. Those things are any aperture of the body. If you wake up and don't wash your hands, then if you touch your eyes, nose, mouth, ears, or any aperture of the body, you can cause serious damage. And this is not just a airy-fairy kind of mystical idea. This has got very practical reality. Or if you touch food, also could be very negative. And therefore, you shouldn't do that. A mother who has to handle a child or a baby also should take a few seconds to wash her. Many people keep water next to their bed. But most hold that if it's in the same house, you can walk to the bathroom, it's not a problem. That's what you should do. The source of that idea is that the neshama flows out through the fingertips. Why that is, also we can't go into now, and what it means, but there is a certain impurity that's left on the hands, which is much worse than when a person uses the bathroom or touches covered parts of your body, which you also have to wash your hands for. Or if you touch an unkosher animal, like a dog, if you have dogs at home, you have a problem, if you know that. If you touch a dog or a cat, any unkosher animal, if you keep a sheep, you're okay. So you should maybe, if you want to change your dogs and cats for sheep and cows, you're okay. But if you touch a dog or a cat or any other unkosher animal, so then you have to wash your hands also before you make any brachos or learn Torah, but it doesn't have any harmful effect. Waking up from half an hour sleep does. Whether you have to do this when you sleep during the day is a big debate among the early authorities. Some say that because we're not sure whether it's the sleep that causes it or the effect of the nighttime. Right? And since we're in doubt, we wash our hands even if we sleep half an hour in the day, or even if we live through a night without sleeping. Either of those will do this for you. But certainly half an hour sleep or more at night time certainly does it. You should be very careful.
What about kissing one's children while asleep?
What about kissing one's children while asleep? Boys. Boys. No, no. There is a concept that someone who's sleeping is has some of those forces that operate that are connected to him, but there's no problem with touching someone who's sleeping. If a boy is out of vomit, so there may be other problems if you touch him when he's sleeping. But that's something else. Yeah, that's it. No more questions on this delicate subject. Fantastic. What it means if you don't remember your dreams is that the question you really mean to ask is what were they there for, right? I mean, if you don't remember it, so what are you going to do about it? You can't recall it deliberately. So we understand that one of the functions of dreams is that there's an emotional and psychic pressure valve, okay, that you live through certain experiences while you're dreaming them, and it has a certain effect. Exactly how and what we don't understand necessarily, and therefore you go through that. Okay, you dream always, and you very seldom remember. One of the signs of significance in terms of prediction and what you should be careful of is if you do remember it clearly. Okay? And not necessarily, that's not the only thing. But one of the elements is if you wake up. Also, if you wake up and you can't remember, but you remember that you're severely disturbed by it, then also you should take care to do various things that you can do for dreams. It's good to live in Israel, because one of the most powerful things that wipes out negative effects of dreams is to hear Birkas Kohanim, the Duchening. When the Kohanim bench the people, that's a very, very powerful time to affect dreams. And in Israel, I do it every day. In Israel, at every minyan in the morning. So you can go out and hear a minyan and hear Birkas Kohanim, make sure you got a minyan, whether the Kohen or Kohanim, and you're okay. But here, you've got to wait until Shavuos or Pesach. Or yeah. Any other questions on dreams? It's a fascinating area. Okay. Another 2 minutes. Let's see. Let's see if we can finish the section. Okay. Just note here, please, that the Rambam says that the reason somebody would connect himself with any of these forces is in order to be an intermediary between him and Hashem. We are not here talking about somebody who doesn't believe in a divine reality. Here we're talking about someone who does believe in it. Only he wishes to have an intermediary to manipulate certain energies, right? Like we mentioned once before, it's like a person who goes into the shop and he wants what's behind the counter. He doesn't care about who owns the shop, so he asks the chap who works in that department to slip him the goods for a very low price, and he pockets, expecting that the chap, the person behind the counter, will pocket the money. He doesn't mind who owns the overall business. That's this kind of individual. He doesn't mind about Hashem. He's just concerned about the direct forces that can give him what he needs. That's how ancient idolatry began. They wanted a god of war and of fertility and of love and of all other things in order just to be able to deliver the goods. They weren't concerned about the overall responsibility. That's what it means to be an intermediary, and that's exactly what's wrong with it. All these five categories of people, all these five subcategories fitting into this major overall category are what we call min. Min meaning this kind of atheistic category. We'll leave it there. Next week, if you want to prepare, you can see the next subsection the Rambam deals with are three subcategories of people who are called apikorsin. I'm just mentioning it now so that you should know it's not the same as this category. The category we've just read are people who don't believe, or they have some problem with a belief in the Creator, one way or another. The second subsection are people who have a problem with their relationship with Hashem. Okay? People who believe that the Torah is not true, or that there's no connection, there's no such thing as prophecy, or there is no such thing as a human heart being able to make some connection or get information that comes from another dimension. Okay? So that is already moving out into the concept of the bridge between us. We'll see it in a minute. Yeah, there's one more question.
Yeah, would a person who engages in the magical acts I don't want to use the word sacrifice, out of a temple context, let's put it that way, with the idea being to control Hashem, would that...
Control the energy?
Yeah, which category would that fall into?
The question here was, what about someone who does certain magical acts or certain sacrificial things? There are two different categories that you've mentioned. Magic, a sleight of hand, that kind of magic.
No, I mean, I would say that magic, using the sociological term of engaging in any physical act with the idea of controlling
the energies.
Spiritual forces.
Yeah. Okay, so let's be clear here. No, hypnotism is another area. One thing at a time. First of all, let's just dispense with magic, okay? Magic that's done by trickery, like at a children's party and so forth, there are many poskim are not happy with that. Okay? Many halachic authorities are not happy with that. You have to be careful. Because it is... There are many reasons that they're not happy with that. Okay? Not for mystical reasons, for halachic reasons. They do hold, however, that there are ways to do it. There are ways in which it can be done, which are not problematic. It might be, even for children, it might be worse. Right? With adults, there are those who write that if you show how it's done afterwards, it might be acceptable. You have to go into that. I'm not going to go into that now. That's a lucky question. Not in the spiritual world at all. But the question here was, what about people who do things, and not just connect with certain energies, but they actually make an attempt to control certain energies. Okay? They want to change things in the world by controlling the root force in the spiritual world. This can be done. And it depends how it's done. The general answer is that it's forbidden, right? Because of the following reason. It can be done in two ways. One is it can be done in a very, very, very negative way. Of course that's forbidden. That's using energies, tapping into energies that are extremely dangerous, okay? And definitely forbidden. But there is a Kabbalistic way of tapping in, using Hashem's names in certain ways, to certain, let's call them malachim, certain forces, let's say in the transcendent world, that do have an effect here. It's called what's called being mashbir amalach. To be mashbir amalach means to take a certain force, an emanation. Let's call it an angel in English. It sounds horrible in English because in English you think I'm talking about a little child with wings on his back flapping around without much clothes on. We're not talking about that. We're talking about a transcendent emanation of power that controls certain things in the world. There are certain ways to control those forces. They are amenable to being contacted and controlled. Unfortunately, the risk of being fried by the voltage, that is much greater than the chance of achieving any positive success. And therefore, all authorities write that of the two Kabbalistic branches of wisdom in the world, Kabbalah Maasis, which is actually doing these things, manufacturing things, producing things, causing magical effects in the world, or even causing seemingly natural effects, and the other branch, which is Kabbalistic wisdom, today only Kabbalistic wisdom is allowed. But to actually manipulate the forces, most people who know anything about this are so careful, they won't even use the name of an angel in speech. They won't even use the name of a malach. Because it says in mystical writings that if you say the name of a malach, if you say his name, he gets very excited. Energy starts to flow to him. He thinks somebody's going to be mashbir him. And he gets a tremendous flow of energy and he starts to vibrate in the spiritual world. I mean, it's very heavy stuff, this. And it can have very, very damaging effects on you. And therefore, people don't. There are exceptions. If you talk about a malach that's mentioned, let's say, in a pasuk, in a verse, or if it happens to be someone's name, there are people who are named after angels. How many names? Right? Michael, Gabriel, all these names. I mean, the English version. But if you say the Hebrew version of somebody which is exactly the angel's name, there's no problem over there. And certainly to mention the ones that have got negative effects in the world that are created for that, create such a vibrant energy in the spiritual world, that one definitely should do that. I'll just end with two examples, just two ideas that I think will interest you. One is that the Arizal, the great Kabbalistic master of the 1500s, late 1500s, 16th century, One morning, Reb Chaim Vital, his famous Talmid, his famous student, the one who wrote all his, who brought down all the Torah of the Arizal, one morning, one night it says, Reb Chaim Vital mentioned one of these words. He just mentioned it in conversation. He mentioned the word which means the shells. The outer shells of reality. I'm not going to say the word for you for sure. But it's the same word in Hebrew as the peels of a fruit. Right? Kuf lamed yud pei. Right? Kali, they say, abbreviation. But the shell of... Normally when you say it, everybody blurts it out. But anyway, the point is the shells that surround reality, which are the outer versions, and therefore contain all the negative energies. This word, once in his study, in the course of his studies, Reb Chaim Vital mentioned it. The next morning, as he walked into the Arizal, he leapt backwards and he said, "Why did you say that word?" Just looked at his face. Just from looking at his face, he said, "Why did you say it?" You follow? When the effect was such that the Arizal could see it on his face the next day. Yeah. Finally, I'll just tell you this. That Sunday night you thought wasn't mystical, right? It's not supposed to be. But let me just mention one more idea that is a very, very fascinating idea. And it's like this. What was referred to here was manipulating certain energies. We have a word in Torah that describes that, and it's called Kishuf. Kishuf means tapping into energies, drawing down energy, and putting in energy in such a way that certain things happen. The Gemara says that anybody who does that, Makhishin Pamalya Shomala. He weakens the power of the spiritual world. That's what it says. He weakens the energy of the spiritual world. He taps in the energy, he lets it flow down in such a way that the store of energy in the spiritual world is not what it should be. Okay? That's what it says. So I once heard a very, very wonderful man, great Rosh Hashiva, today he's been on his 90s. He once looked across the table at me and he said the following thing. He said, "I think..." This is the way he put it. I'll just tell you the way he put it, okay, for what it's worth. I think I might have mentioned it to one or two of you, some of you before, but I'll leave you with this idea. He said the following thing. He said, "You know, when I was in New York, I went on the subway." This is a man who has the whole capitalistic world at his fingertips, but he'll never admit it. So he never talks that way. He always talks like this, okay? But you have to understand what's going on in the background. He always talks, he'll take the capitalistic world, he wants to teach you something, so he'll teach you, he'll put it in a way that's very, very ordinary, and then he'll say he thinks that it's probably like this. Now that's what he does. So once I was happened to be learning with him, he leaned across the table and he said, "You know, the other day I was in the subway in New York, and the lights went out." I sat there waiting for the rest of the story. He said, "And while I was sitting in the dock on the subway, I saw that little lights came on that were emergency lights. They have an emergency system. When the main system fails, there's a backup system that kicks in automatically. And then, when I saw that, I suddenly realized that the body's like that. The human body's also like that. There's many systems in the body that each keep each other one all backed up. There's energies that keep all the other ones, mean feedback systems, that back up all the others. So then I thought to myself that actually what it means is that there's primary energies and then there's backup energies. But the remarkable thing is that the primary energy is always much more powerful than the backup energy. The backup energy is just enough to do the job to get you through until the primary energy can be instituted again." So then I started thinking to myself, this is the way I put it to me. So I started thinking to myself that if the body works that way, probably the whole world works that way. Probably there are primary energies in the world, and then probably there are secondary energies. Then I started thinking to myself that probably the way it works is that we actually live on the secondary energy. We don't live on the primary energy because we can't afford to use up the primary energy. So what happens is we just live on the backup systems, right? And the world never expends its primary energy. A bit like a bank account. You've got a lot of money in the bank. You don't want to break into the capital. So what happens is you just live on the interest and you let the capital be around. But in an emergency, you might have to use the capital. That's what the city... And it seems to me that if you look at... Like an old man like myself said, if I was walking down the road and somebody, and I tried to run, I couldn't run. I'm too old, I can't run. But if somebody started chasing me, tried to kill me, I'd run very fast. But then, when the danger was over, I'd be completely exhausted. I'd be dangerously exhausted. Because what actually is happening is that normally I have an energy inside of me, but I can't tap into that energy because it's hidden behind a lock. You hear this? Think about this for the next few weeks. It's amazing. There's an energy in the world that's hidden behind a very, very clever lock. The lock can't be picked. You can't open that lock. But when the lock has to be broken, it breaks open immediately. There are certain keys in the body that can open those locks. For example, adrenaline. That's what he said. When you're walking along and you want to do something that's impossible physically, or leap over a wall that's impossible for any human being to leap over, it's a joke if you try and do it. But if they release the local pit bull, or whatever they call it, right, that's got enough
teeth to bite that person's leg off, so when he's halfway across the road, will easily fly over such a wall. And why? Because, and there's stories from the Holocaust also, people who did things that were seemingly impossible, because there's a lock that prevents you from getting into that energy. Why is the lock there? Because if you could tap into that energy, you'd kill yourself. You'd release forces in the body. You hear this? The very wise man. You'd release forces in the body that would tap into your primary sources, and you'd expend them, and you wouldn't be able to carry on. So what happens is they're locked away, and they only use them when the alternative is death, like a life and death situation. He said drugs do that. When a person takes drugs, what happens is they release energies that actually should be locked away. And therefore they cause a lot of damage because of that. And then he sat back for a long time and he said, and I wonder if we aren't messing around with the locks in the universe, when we're playing around with nuclear energy and things like that, I just wondered to myself, if we aren't messing around with the locks that hold the energy where it should be, and we aren't trying to release primary energies that are supposed to be hidden away, we're only a little dribble, because actually nuclear energy in the world, what the world lives on is the tiniest little dribble that comes out of the nuclear energy, but it's enough to keep the world going. But these brainy individuals, not the people who think they know what they're doing, they want to pick those locks and get into the primary, and he says they blow the planet apart that way. Well, he said he wasn't sure, but he was wondering about it. Okay.